National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, September 20th in 2023, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, from across the nation, and sometimes from other parts of the world to explore American national security interests. We've got a fascinating show for you today. We're going to take a look at the intersection of cyber operations and a somewhat new phenomenon called hacktivism. And we'll apply the knowledge we learn about those two subjects to a real-world ongoing experiment, Ukraine. With us to consider this topic is Dr. Vasilios Karaginopoulos. Vasilios Karaginopoulos graduated from Athens Law School and completed a master's degree in information technology law and a doctorate in law at the University of Strathclyde Law School. Since 2014, he's been working at the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Portsmouth in the United Kingdom, where he is now an associate professor in cybercrime and cybersecurity and co-director of the newly launched Research Center for Cybercrime and Economic Crime. Vasilios led the design and launch of a Bachelor of Science in Criminology and Cybercrime in 2018, and he's the director of the Cybercrime Awareness Clinic, an innovation hub that has secured funding from various national and international bodies to work on cybercrime awareness projects with vulnerable groups and organizations. Vasilios has published extensively in national and international journals and magazines in relation to cybercrime and information technology law and politics, as well as internet regulations, cyber awareness, and research ethics, and he participates regularly in both national and international academic and practitioner conferences. He's also won the National Cyber Award for Cyber Awareness in 2020 and a high commendation in 2022 for his clinic work, and was named Privacy Leader in Academia at the 2022 Picasso Awards. Dr. Vasilios Karaginopoulos, welcome to National Security This Week.
Glad to be here.
And where are you sitting this morning, or I guess I should say this afternoon for you?
Yes, it is afternoon. I am in Brighton in the UK. I work for the University of Portsmouth, obviously, but I'm based in Brighton, which is a city an hour away from Portsmouth.
Okay. Well, we're very, very excited to have you on the show today. The wonders of modern technology make you seem like you're right in front of me here on Zoom. So I'm looking forward to our discussion. So you mentioned before we got on the air to go ahead and call you Voss. Let's begin our that'll be a little easier for me to say as somebody who struggles with English in general. But let's begin our cyber-centric discussions today by explaining some of the terms we'll use throughout our discussion. I think it'll be instructive for all of us, especially for me. But let's start with this first term, cyber awareness. You spend time focusing on this topic when you advocate for cybersecurity. What exactly is cyber awareness in this world?
Yeah, thank you. So as you mentioned, I run a cybercrime awareness clinic, and we tend to mention cyber awareness as a short term, let's say, for cybercrime awareness or cybersecurity awareness in general. Cyber awareness is essentially the effort to educate the public, to educate citizens, organizations, and even, you know, governments and other stakeholders in relation to the risks and threats around the internet, criminal threats, security threats, but also to educate about proper behavior, etiquette online, critical thinking and media literacy, and so on. So it's a very wide term that encompasses, let's say, all the necessary kind of awareness and education that we need in cyberspace to be functional cyber citizens.
And because you study this topic, I have to think that, I mean, your awareness of how much, I guess, hacking or penetration attempts on networks all around the world, it's happening constantly, millions of times a day, right?
Yes, indeed. So obviously, with the advent of time and how internet has become so popular, and especially after COVID-19 and the lockdowns, we've become even more reliant on technology and internet connections and networks, and information more generally. We are gradually seeing more and more attacks on information networks.
So we really need to be practicing cyber awareness all the time when we're online, right?
Definitely. This is what we're preaching with the Cybercrime Awareness Clinic. And I'm also co-director of the Center for Cybercrime and Economic Crime at the university here. So we are currently involved in various different projects. And what we're trying to communicate and identify as well is various different new ways, new technologies that we can implement to help people become more aware, but also protect themselves and prevent victimization.
Let me throw a few more terms at you so that both me and our listeners we're all on the same page, so we can sort of understand everything you're going to tell us afterwards.
Definitely.
Cybersecurity. What exactly does that mean in your lexicon?
Well, I mean, cybersecurity is a very peculiar term because it's been, in a way, demonized by the public in the sense that I'll explain what I mean. So we've done a lot of work with the general public and various different age groups, young people, older adults, for example, and even, you know, small businesses. And what we're seeing in general is that cybersecurity is seen as something that's very technical, very jargonistic, even as a term in itself, and people shy away from it. But in reality, cybersecurity is all the various different efforts that we make to make ourselves more secure online. It's nothing more complicated than that. Then, you know, you've got various different dimensions to cybersecurity. Obviously, there's a technical dimension in the sense that we would, let's say, implement an antivirus software to protect us from malware, or we would have firewalls, or we would update our software and download patches for our various different programs that we're running on our computers. These are all the technical elements, but there's also a lot of cybersecurity that is not technical and relates to how we critically analyze messages that we might be receiving, for example, or whether we have established processes for dealing with any compromises if we're talking about a business environment.
Okay, for the next few terms, maybe let's just go briefly because I think it'll become kind of obvious what we're talking about as we go through the rest, but I think we need a baseline. Cybercrime.
Well, cybercrime is any kind of crime that happens online, really. We've got different categorizations. Cyber-dependent ones, for example, are cyber crimes like hacking and viruses and crimes that did not exist before the internet, let's say. And cyber-enabled ones are crimes like fraud, but happening online as well. And we've got, you know, a very wide variety in both these categorizations.
Okay. So in my world, in the intelligence world, this next term has some controversy to it because nobody's, I think, really sure what it actually means. Cyber terrorism. What exactly is that in your mind?
Well, you did mention it. It's a very, very complicated term. Even defining terrorism is very complicated in general. So cyber terrorism is even more complicated. I guess it's attacks that would be targeting usually important networks, critical infrastructures, for example, with the aim of causing fear in the public and coercing governments into accepting demands by political groups, for example, or you know, spreading fear and promoting radical ideologies by distracting critical infrastructures.
This next term is important because it goes on all the time. It's become sort of almost a main element of the world of intelligence. But cyber espionage.
Yeah. Again, as we say, these terms are very contested in terms of the definitions. you're starting me with the complicated ones here. But cyber espionage is essentially all this underlying kind of cyber warfare that is not necessarily a declared war between states, but it's all the stolen information and all the hacking that happens in the background between governments or corporations, for example, where one attacker is trying to get confidential information, new intellectual property, and other associated important information from the other parties in order to gain a competitive advantage, for example, or advantage in, a war, let's say.
So we will be talking about this in great depth, but there's both offensive and defensive cyber warfare. You sort of mentioned a little bit as a component part of advanced cyber espionage, per se. But how about the term hacktivism? Let's define that before we move on.
Well, yes, hacktivism is a term that has been used quite broadly to relate to political hacking. Hacking with political motivations, for example, and we are going to analyze it a lot more. So that's probably the simplest term that we can use for the start, and then obviously we're going to go a little bit deeper.
All right, so we've got our baseline on what some of these terms mean. Hopefully I'll remember them as we go through. But let's start our discussion today. Let's use Ukraine as our case study to see how some of these cyber-centric terms, these capabilities have been applied. And I think we can do this best by considering the phases we've seen so far in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. What was the situation in Ukraine ahead of the Russian invasion? In other words, was Ukraine under a sort of a constant probing operation on the cyber world from Moscow or others? I know it's difficult to accurately attribute who's doing things in the cyber arena. That's one of the benefits of doing cyber operations. But were the Russians or their proxies seeking to gain some sort of a technological advantage over Ukraine by using cyber espionage and even cyber warfare, undeclared, to undermine Ukrainian situational awareness or Ukrainian command control or other aspects, maybe critical infrastructure? What were you seeing before the Russians invaded Ukraine?
Yeah, thanks, John. I think what you mentioned is very critical. Attribution is something that is very hard to be 100% certain of. And also, you mentioned government and proxies. So this is something we are seeing a lot in these situations where there's a lot of hacking attacks, a lot of compromises, a lot of cyber attacks happening between states, but it's very rare that a government will come out openly and claim responsibility for an attack. And this is why we say cyber espionage between states and cyber warfare can sometimes overlap, because we have what you mentioned, non-declared cyber warfare, which essentially manifests as cyber espionage. In the case of Ukraine, we do know, obviously, there had been conflicts in previous years as well, in the Crimea area as well. So we do know that there has been a constant kind of conflict between hackers from Russia attacking Ukrainian targets. There was a particular piece of malware called NotPetya, that was designed to target Ukrainian government networks using a particular piece of software, and then obviously it spilled over because we're all interconnected, so it's very hard to actually say, oh, I'm just going to target networks within a particular national space where we're all interconnected, and where the compromises happen through software that not just one country will be using in their services, but other countries might be using as well. And we saw billions of dollars being lost by systems that were not operating because of NotPetya, for example. So we definitely have seen a constant kind of testing of the defenses between the two states. There have been attacks on the power grid as well against Ukraine, which sort of left certain parts of the country without electricity for a few hours. But it's very, very hard to actually attribute those attacks to the government. So there is a reputation that the Secret Services, the GRU, are behind certain attacks, or these are state-sponsored hacking groups, or state-supported or state-funded, but they could also be nationalistic hacking groups that are doing it in order to support their country, for example. And it's very hard to actually identify this.
Okay. For our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Vasilios Karagiannopoulos, and we're discussing cyber operations, the concept of hacktivism, and the role of cyber in the war in Ukraine. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, and you can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. All right, so Russia invaded Ukraine in late February of 2022. What changed in the cyber arena once the major ground offensive began and Russian forces punched across the border into Ukraine? Did experts like you see significant operational expansion of cyber warfare by Russia or proxies that were targeting Ukraine during that time? Or was it a dramatic expanse in both defensive and offensive cyber operations by Ukraine to defend itself from being a cyber attacked? I mean, what were you seeing in those opening months of the conflict?
Well, we saw some very interesting phenomena. First of all, we did see an attack on the Viasat satellite network just before the invasion. And that was meant to create some communication gap in the Ukrainian forces so they couldn't really monitor the movements of Russian troops as they were invading as well. But we also saw that this cyber attack impacted on various other networks across the globe. Plenty of these countries that had networks affected were NATO countries. So it was a very complicated initial attack that sort of coincided with the invasion. Even before the start of the invasion, it was pretty clear that Russia was preparing something. Because troops were gathering around the border, as we know. So that resulted in cyber attacks happening on both sides much more intensively. And we can actually say that because there was this concern that Russia would invade in the weeks just before the invasion attack, we did see a lot of hacker and hacktivist groups actually rallying to support Ukraine and then declaring war against Russia, cyber war, yeah, in the sense of, you know, activist cyber war, as hacktivists usually do, and attacking various different Russian websites, government websites, corporate websites, stealing information and releasing that information online or sharing it with the Ukrainian government. We did see something that I feel is a very unique thing as well. We saw a government minister from Ukraine, Fedorov, actually coming out and calling hackers, not just from Ukraine, but from around the globe, to rally and become part of its IT army. We do know that most countries nowadays would have their own kind of cyber operations branch and maybe even hiring hacker groups to help them out, or having them as a reserve force in the cyber forces. But it was the first time that we actually saw a government official openly inviting hackers to join the Ukrainian IT army and supplement the efforts of the Ukrainian government to defend itself.
So is this sort of where this term hacktivism really kind of comes into being, is that you're looking for activists with hacking skills to join this capability to defend the democracy that was Ukraine from this invasion by a foreign power?
Well, hacktivism is a very old term, actually. So we have seen a lot of iterations of hacktivism across the years. So if I may do a very brief kind of historic overview of hacktivism.
Absolutely.
Thanks, John. Hacktivism started in the 90s, even. And we do know the reliance on information networks at the time and the internet speeds that we had and even, you know, the spaces that we were converting to in the 90s, in the late 90s, had nothing to do with what we are doing today online. But the reality is that hacktivism started in the late 90s by groups that were a mix of political activists, but also network artists or computer scientists that were very politically sensitized, for example, or hackers that were very, very politically sensitized. And they formed various different groups, like the Electronic Disturbance Theater, for example, or hacktivismo, or the electro hippies, and they organized various different kinds of protests that we tend to characterize as virtual graffiti, where you deface a web page in order to communicate a political message. And we've seen a lot of that with Ukraine as well. A lot of Ukrainian hackers, for example, or Russian hackers would be defacing, changing how a website looks and putting in a political message, for example, in support of whatever side they are on anyway. And then we had the advent of Anonymous in the zeros. Yeah, we had a brief kind of trough of activity in the early zeros, but then around the mid zeros, we started seeing Anonymous happening as a much more fluid kind of collective. The groups that we had initially were much smaller, and they were very open about their identities, pretty much. At least many of them were very known to the public. With Anonymous, we are seeing a shift. These offenses, denial of service attacks, or virtual sit-ins, as hacktivists call them, become criminalized. Defacements are obviously hacking attacks as well that are criminalized. And law enforcement agencies and governments are much more interested in prosecuting these kinds of attacks. So we are seeing a shift from the openness of identity that we had in previous years. And we have seen a lot of activity from Anonymous happening a decade ago, for example, or 15 years ago, in relation to various different issues, in relation to WikiLeaks, for example, in relation to Donald Trump, in relation to ISIS, and exposing, you know, affiliated terrorists. Even pedophile rings have been exposed by hacktivists. So we have seen a lot of activity in previous years. And now with the war in Ukraine, we are seeing the introduction of hacktivists into this new kind of arena, where we actually have a conflict between two different nations.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Anonymous. I think that group is one that most people have probably heard of in the news because of the fairly high profile things that they have done in the past, you know, leaking information that they've been able to get access to through their hacking efforts. Clearly, sort of a political objective on the part of that particular group. Never really, you know, quote unquote, identified as, you know, Anonymous. We don't really know who's involved, a loose grouping of people with a unique set of skills, probably ebbs and flows as far as how many people are involved. I do know that in the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the people who, you know, are part of Anonymous, the whole point is we don't know who they are, but they jumped in to try and help Ukrainian people in defending their nation. So where are we at today? I mean, we're 19 months into this conflict. What kind of transition have you seen, you and your colleagues seen over the last 18-19 months with regards to cyber operations on both sides of this conflict, whether they be state run or proxies or hacktivists jumping in? I can't imagine the Ukrainian IT army is actually able to go in and say, "Hey, Anonymous, identify who you individuals are so we can guide your efforts." They're still going to be anonymous. They're still going to do what they want to do, but they're going to do it in support potentially of Ukraine and Ukraine's defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. We are seeing, first of all, a lot of overlap between people that might have joined the IT army, but also belong to other hacker groups that might be helping out in one way or another. On the other hand, because of all this kind of hacking activity in support of Ukraine, we have seen that the big hacker groups that exist in Russia, and we know Russia has a big tradition in terms of big ransomware gangs and hacker groups, have rallied accordingly to support Russia in these efforts and counterattack when, for example, Anonymous or other groups are attacking different networks, banking networks, media, stations, TV stations, radio stations, and so on, and a lot of other kind of corporate and government networks. We are seeing similar activity on the side of Russia. We did not see the major cyber attacks that were anticipated initially, and that was that has been a surprise along the way, because when the war started, there was a concern that Russia had a lot of firepower in terms of cyber attacking, and they would put it to clear use. And there are various theories, but for me, I guess one of the most realistic theories is that a lot of firepower on the side of Ukraine has also rallied together to defend and prevent attacks like that. And we know big corporations, for example, like Microsoft and Amazon, have offered services alongside governments like the US government, the UK government, and other NATO partners. And therefore, we could perhaps have seen more attacks happening from the side of Russia, but they have been moderated because of that concerted effort from the allies.
So we're going to just take a brief commercial break to recognize our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. We will be right back in about 60 seconds with our continuing show on cyber.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back here on National Security This Week with Dr. Vasilios Karaginopoulos, and we're discussing cyber operations, this concept of hacktivism as it's being applied, and how cyber is being used in the Ukraine war. So Dr. Karaginopoulos used the term in an article that you co-authored with Professor Athena Karagiani. Is that close? How do I?
Yeah, Karagiani.
Karagiani,
yeah.
From the University of Leicester. There's a term in there, not really a term, the name of a group in there, cyber partisans. Let's continue our discussions on the war in Ukraine by considering this issue of the cyber partisans and their operations, principally operating from Belarus. What trends are you seeing from this cyber partisan group? And to me, it sounds a little bit like some of the hacktivism operations that are going on tend to be a little bit more independent. But this cyber partisan group, they might be getting guidance from a nation state like Belarus or Russia. The cyber partisan group, are acting, as I understand, against Ukraine in support of Russia from outside the theater of operations. So in Belarus or someplace somewhere in the world. Can you describe who the cyber partisans are and what they're doing?
Sure, John. Just to clarify, the
Yep.
cyber partisans are actually supporting Ukraine and not
Oh, they are.
against
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Russia. So the cyber partisans formed for very nation-based reasons. They are a hacktivist group that is trying to highlight the politically corrupt practices of the Lukashenko regime in Belarus. And we know Belarus and Russia and their regimes are very close. We know Lukashenko is very close to Putin, for example. And we have seen efforts to support Russia by allowing Russian troops to go through Belarus and all that. So in terms of the cyber partisans have declared that they are more interested in actually focusing on their particular kind of national goal of ousting the Lukashenko regime and bringing a more democratic kind of regime to Belarus. But because of the very close involvement of the Belarusian regime with the war in Ukraine and supporting Russia, they've had to also take part in, or they got involved because of that process anyway. So we did see, for example, the cyber partisans hacking the train ticket system in Belarus, in order to delay the trains when they found out that Belarusian trains were actually being used to transport Russian troops to the border just before the invasion. And because of that action, they were branded as terrorists by the regime. But it's a small group of hackers and other activists. And they even have a spokesperson. So no one really knows what the other members are or look like. But they do have a spokesperson that actually goes around the world and gives interviews and explains what the cause is. And they collaborate with other activist groups.
So it's. I'm glad you mentioned the railway network inside Belarus, because there was another article that just came out a little while ago talking about a hack that disrupted Poland's railway system, which has been vitally important for moving military supplies, from more Western Europe into the Ukrainian border to get these weapon systems into the Ukrainians to fight the Russian invasion. So. And this was a simple hack. Apparently, they hacked into the radio network that then disrupted the entire Polish network system. So, the systems of systems that we have that exist today. Are you seeing increased vulnerability to these kinds of technological hacks and what they can do to disrupt sort of these systems of systems that control so many aspects of our life? In this case, we're talking about. You know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but it's clearly spilling out over to other areas, not only in Europe, but around the world. The article that you and your colleague wrote sort of discussed a lot of other areas around the world where this hacktivism is taking place. It's something we really need to become far more aware of.
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned, we have seen hacking attacks on both sides. And on various critical infrastructures like banking systems, you know, communication systems, transport systems. So it is our reliance on these networks is becoming more and more advanced and more complicated as well. And we do know that with the wider reliance on information networks, there's more opportunities for cyber criminals, cyber terrorists, or cyber espionage agents to find ways for committing these attacks, for stealing information, for introducing malware to the systems, and so on.
So this term partisan. That goes back to World War II. It's got sort of a famous, heritage to it. The people who consider themselves partisans in World War II were operating really independently of government direction in many cases. As things became more organized in the resistance to the Nazis, where they held power, you'd have sort of the Allied governments giving direction to these organizations. So. Cyber partisans as an individual, as a group operating out of Belarus or against Belarus, I should say, that might be the first of a wave of new, more organized hacking operations, independent operations that groups or individuals even are carrying out. Are you seeing a trend line along those lines as cyber becomes more and more embedded in the world?
Yeah, I would say, I think the cyber partisans would like to think they are operating for Belarus rather than against Belarus. They're operating against, what they think is a corrupt government in Belarus with the aim of improving things according to their views. But I would say, because you're mentioning the partisan concept more widely, I think this is just a name they have adopted, but if we want to see it on a more conceptual basis, I would say that we are seeing a lot of activists and hackers becoming part of this conflict that is happening in the Ukraine and Russia, with very active kind of roles sometimes, especially when we're talking about hackers joining the IT army. And there are talks that the IT army is, at the moment, let's say, a selection of vigilante hackers, perhaps, that want to support Ukraine, and they're not really acting as part of an organized military force. But that might change, because there are talks about Ukraine actually adding the IT army as a formal branch of its military operations, military kind of body. So if that happens, and they are formally introduced into the whole kind of system, then obviously that changes what they are exactly. They could become, for example, combatants in terms of international law. So if that happens, it will be the first time that we have seen it happening in a real conflict. And I think we are seeing a trend that is changing the nature of hacktivism, yes.
So let's transition our discussion a little bit away from direct conflict, state-to-state conflict, and the kind of things that happen in support or against nation states during conflict timeframes. One of the really attractive things about cyber operations, you mentioned it earlier, is that attribution is very difficult to assign. That's one of the benefits of cyber. It can be very difficult to identify who carried out the cyber operation in the first place, and a really good hacking group or individual can probably figure out a way to pin it on somebody else to make make it even more complex to figure out who's actually doing things. So Anonymous is a well-named group because of their ability to hack and hack into things and people don't know who did it. So another area where you have a great deal of expertise is this the cyber criminal arena, cyber crime. Do you see any crossover between these kind of partisan, anonymous cyber operations on the national defense side of things, the national security side of things, and the cyber criminal behavior? I mean, do you see any sort of crossover there? So, for instance, would a partisan attack in the cyber arena on Russia's banking network, would that be criminal in nature, or would it be a support of the cause to defend Ukraine, or is it both? Is it both? I mean, if you had a criminal entity that went in and attacked the Russian banking network and stole ₹1 billion out of the system, is that criminal activity, or is that in support of defending Ukraine, or both? I mean, well, how would you frame it as somebody with so deep background in law and cyber?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question, because we are seeing this happening. We are seeing a lot of overlap. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of hacker groups and ransomware groups that were very active in the cyber criminal arena, introducing ransomware and stealing money and cryptocurrency ransom from various different organizations, actually shifting their attention and their efforts or repurposing their cyber weapons, let's say, to support Russia in this kind of conflict. So we definitely have seen these organized crime groups online actually taking a much more political stance and using their cyber criminal activities and maybe even the income gained from these activities in support of the Russian cause. Having said that, I think we have seen cyber criminals doing this in various different occasions. That's not a problem. The big question here, and I'm glad you highlighted this, is that when you've got a hacker actually hacking another organization across borders, they're still committing a criminal offense, usually, in the country they are in, violating the Computer Misuse Act, for example, in the UK, or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in the US. And the question is, should they be prosecuted? So I think there is no interest in actually prosecuting, and that's why they are not prosecuted. And it's very hard to actually identify what they've done, when they've done it. And obviously, a U.S. prosecutor might not be interested in prosecuting someone who is actually supporting the cause in Ukraine. But in reality, if we want to look at it in a black and white kind of legal perspective, they definitely violate criminal laws in the countries that they might be in.
It does raise some very interesting theoretical questions, certainly some challenging questions in a legal framework, especially on the international side of things, because, I mean, the global economy is so interwoven today. And when you overlay state-to-state conflict or competition, especially when it gets really aggressive, These kinds of issues that come up make for an interesting theoretical discussion that really has real-world implications.
Yeah, I mean, it's a global phenomenon at the moment, and it's so widespread that we are seeing it is very difficult to actually identify what has happened, first of all, because of the attribution issues. Yeah, we do see a lot of groups, for example, coming out and saying they've done certain hacks. But one of the questions is, have they actually done them?
Right.
Because then you might just go and visit the website they say they've taken down, and it might still be up and running for you. So there's that question. And then the other issue is, you know, if you wanted to prosecute, would you have enough evidence to actually prove that it was this particular group that has done it? Because as you said, hackers have the opportunity to evade and then mask where they're coming from and what they've done, and even pin it on someone else.
So I'm gonna continue on this area of sort of the theoretical. So with international terrorism, there isn't an accepted definition of terrorism at even amongst the UN membership, and part of that is the old adage of one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, right? So the international community, individual states, they don't come to an agreement on what terrorism actually is. Cyber, I think, especially with new tools coming on, these advancing machine language learning programs, you know, AI as we call it so far, it's still kind of the wild, wild west. I think there's probably a hesitation on the part of most governments, especially the ones with the most advanced capabilities, to really want to negotiate and enter into any kind of an international control regime on cyber operations, because we still know so little about this. You study this issue, cybersecurity, cybercrime, you understand the law in the cyber arena. What do you see are the big impediments to nations wanting to move forward with some sort of an international treaty on cyber?
Well, first of all, we have seen some efforts from the UN actually to create a cybercrime treaty. Yeah, we do have a convention on cybercrime from 2001 that has been ratified by certain countries, but obviously after so many years, it has now become a little bit obsolete. So we're trying to create a new kind of effort to identify what the cybercrimes that we need to deal with are and how we should be dealing with these. But we do have a lot of regimes and a lot of governments and nations that have very different perceptions on what should be criminalized, how it should be criminalized, and so on. So I think this is the main impediment, finding that kind of common ground, that consensus between, for example, countries like China, Russia, the US, the UK, France, Brazil, Australia, African countries, for example, and so on. It's not an easy thing. We have seen that even creating legislation within the UK, for example, that I am based on, can be quite problematic with a new online safety bill and how contested some of the issues in this bill have become. Imagine trying to do this with so many countries actually having an interest in shaping the law.
It's a fascinating topic. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Vasilios Karagiannopoulos, and we're discussing cyber operations, hacktivism, and the role of cyber in the war in Ukraine, amongst other topics. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, which is about a month away now, and you can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. So, Vaz, we're down to about 14 minutes left in the show. Goes by just like that. I want to pull back out and talk about a few different topics with you because you're the expert.
Sure.
Maybe we could keep it tight, 2 to 3 minutes on each of these topics to sort of explain it to our listeners. Our mutual friend Sean Costigan is involved in NATO's cyber policy development. The U.S. also has now a cyber czar position, someone who's supposed to sort of coordinate across the U.S. government for cyber policy and whatnot. Are the governments in the democratic nations of the world, especially the U.S. and our NATO allies in particular, are they doing enough in the cyber arena to defend against attacks, whether by nation states or non-state actors, Or are we doing enough to kind of crack down on the cyber criminal world? It seems like every couple of days we hear in the news about some new hack that took place, some company that was penetrated, you know, data was exfiltrated, you know, money secured, a lot of these criminal activities that are taking place. But there's lots of penetration going on across the web. Are the liberal democratic governments of the world doing enough to combat it?
That's a difficult question to answer, because I think, yes, we are doing a lot to deal with the various different issues, but there are so many issues and things are moving so quickly. We are seeing so many issues coming up with the new kind of development of the large language models and generative design and AI and so on, that by the time we've dealt with the cyber issues that we've got today, we've got new issues that we should be dealing with. And I know, for example, for a fact that the UK government is very keen to explore what the challenges might be in this AI, you know, landscape, for example. I'm pretty sure the US is doing the same, and all the countries, really, to be honest. But we started very late, I think, with cyber, because everyone was being very liberal about letting people use the internet and doing promoting commerce and promoting that new technology, and now we're struggling to catch up, and I think there's a lot of investment in various different schemes dealing with various different types of cybercrime and cybersecurity issues, but there is a lot of interest in engaging in cybercrime, because it's very profitable as well. So we could be doing more, definitely, and we are trying to do more from our end as well, through the clinic and, you know, our research with the center, and I'm pretty sure, you know, other colleagues are doing the same, but it's not easy.
It's my belief, I think, based on what I've seen, that the trend lines are that the transnational organized crime groups, the really big transnational organized crime groups, they used to make a vast majority of their money on the drug trade, the international drug trade, but they're using those finances to shift into the cyber arena to make an unbelievable amount of money through cyber crime, which is very hard to detect. It's very hard to have an attribution, and it's very hard to prosecute. Let me ask you one other question here, which I find absolutely fascinating, and it's about the changed landscape. Of who must be involved in international conflict today. Companies are being drawn into conflicts like the war in Ukraine, whether they want to be or not. Microsoft, as an example, you mentioned Microsoft earlier, finds itself really on the front lines of both cyber warfare and combating cyber crime on a constant basis, because they do security monitoring for their own company and also for their clients around the world. They're constantly coming up with patches, security patches for software, et cetera. Can you talk a bit about how corporations in the technology sector are kind of de facto at this point directly involved in certain aspects of global confrontation?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great point, and we did mention that Microsoft and Amazon and other companies have been quite involved in supporting Ukraine, for example, and providing defenses and providing reports in terms of upcoming threats and all that. So we definitely see that cybersecurity is gradually becoming something that big organizations get involved in much more actively. And especially if you are offering cloud services or, you know, operating systems or applications, for example, that are being used by a vast amount of users, then you're bound to have an interest in not just maintaining your cybersecurity, but even creating products that other people can use and other companies can use and even nations can use to protect themselves. So in the same way that cybercrime has become very profitable, cybersecurity is gradually becoming not just a profitable but a necessary elements in our everyday lives, and we're bound to see organizations becoming more and more involved in these areas.
It is my understanding that when the World Wide Web was sort of constructed, it was designed, as you mentioned earlier, to be a completely open network that anybody can access under any circumstances kind of a thing. It wasn't really the focus of creating the World Wide Web wasn't on security. There was very little thought given to the security of how the web should work. And I know there's been some discussions on the part of computer scientists about designing a completely new World Wide Web with the focus being security as being the number one piece to that. So it's still completely usable by everybody, but there are security protocols that would be built into the system, the new system, from the get-go. Are you hearing more discussion about things like that in your world?
I think there's a lot of initiatives in relation to, for example, creating more decentralized, more privacy enhancing kind of application, what we call the Web 3.0, in a way. I have to say the big corporations that are running things online now, like, you know, Meta or Google or Amazon or Microsoft, they are, and their products are very, very established at the moment. So it is very hard to actually create something that will appeal to the general public so widely that they will migrate from, you know, all these big platforms that we all use today to a new kind of system. It will be very revolutionary, and it will have to be very revolutionary. And at the same time, we are seeing that with AI. We have a lot of new applications that are being embedded into these technologies that we are already using.
Yeah,
so that makes them even more appealing.
Yeah, and I do have on my list of questions of things I wanted to ask you about this artificial intelligence. I mean, ChatGPT was launched less than a year ago, and it almost instantaneously started to revolutionize what the large language models could do when they're asked to create something. And in this world of cyber, functions like ChatGPT have been asked to create new, cyber hacking tools, and they almost instantly are able to write new code that people can then put to word. I mean, where do you see this going with this world of artificial intelligence? And do we need to do more to regulate the world of AI before it just outpaces anything that the human mind can kind of keep track of and control?
It is scary and fascinating at the same time,
right,
I would say.
Exactly.
and I start with scary first, but it is also fascinating, especially if you're in this field and you're seeing how things unfold and what might be happening in a few years' time, both in terms of how this would revolutionize our everyday lives, but how it can revolutionize all the criminal and security threats that we are already facing today. I really think we do need, you mentioned introducing security in the design, and I think we are doing the same mistake now. We're not introducing security in the design of all these kind of new tools that we are implementing. Not adequate security. There is an element of security as well, but we are rushing to bring products to the market, and then sometimes security becomes an afterthought. And I think we need to be more careful because there's a lot of potential, and it will happen much faster. The changes that this will bring about will happen much faster than what the internet did in the last 30 years.
So we just have a few minutes left today before we close out the show. I know you're connected to the Cybersecurity Summit, our sponsor for the show. I should mention the summit will be held from October 24th to the 26th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Bloomington, Minnesota. Still, my understanding, you're not able to attend in person this year. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, no. Yeah, I have some other commitments that have prevented me from being able to attend.
Are you going to
really sorry about that?
But... Well, I understand. Are you going to try and participate to a certain extent remotely at all? Are there any specific topics that are happening at this year's Cybersecurity Summit that, or speakers that are coming in that are really fascinating to you personally?
I will try, but I'm not going to be in the country, and I'll be abroad for work, so I'm not really sure what I will be able to do with this.
Well, I'll have to talk to Sean Costigan about that, because we need to get somebody with your expertise and background to participate in future cybersecurity summits. I always try to give my guests the last word here on National Security This Week. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners regarding cyber operations, hacktivism, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or anything else linked to cyber happening around the world today. The floor is yours, sir.
Yeah, thank you, John. What I would like to say is that there is a lot of misinformation and fear-mongering and panic around all these issues that we discussed today. And I think it's important for everyone to try to become more aware of these issues, and also to double-check what they are reading, what they are sharing online, and what they are believing, because I think it's important to get that kind of more holistic view of what is happening, and take steps to improve our personal security. And through our personal security, I think we can improve overall security, because we're all interconnected. And as we say, we're all as secure as the weakest link. So if we can eliminate or improve the security of the weakest links, then we'll make steps forward.
So Dr. Vasilios Karagiannopoulos from the University of Portsmouth, thank you for joining us today on National Security This Week. Are there any publications you'd like to point out to our listeners, or websites, anything that you think would be really great to help people to better understand some of these issues?
Yeah, definitely. I have written some relevant articles for the Conversation magazine in relation to the war in Ukraine, but also hacktivism, and one on the IT army might be coming up soon. So keep an eye out for that. I've also written a book on hacktivism more generally, if you're interested in the more historic elements before 2017. My book is called Living with Hacktivism. And I'm currently writing the next book on hacktivism as well, which will integrate all these Ukraine-related topics that we discussed today. So this will probably come out sometime in the next year.
Okay. So if people go to our KYMN radio website or the podcast services and they can see the correct spelling of your name, they can put that in their search bar and they can quickly find you. What courses are you teaching this year?
I'm teaching various different lectures on various different courses. I'm coordinating a module on cyber law governance and human rights. And I'm also teaching in digital investigation, cybersecurity. If you all are interested, there's also a TV series I've taken part in where I discuss digital evidence and how law enforcement is using digital evidence to catch murderers. I don't know if I'm allowed to say where this is found, John.
Sure, go ahead. Yes, absolutely.
You know, so it's on Amazon Prime in the US. And it's called Killer's Cotton Camera.
Okay. Dr. Vasilios Karagiannopoulos, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning here on National Security This Week.
Thank you for inviting me, John.
And folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.